I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
Next interview is with Ed Wilson. He's the executive director for the International Justice Mission here in Canada. We talk about a lot of things. We talk about violence. We talk about injustice and justice and law enforcement models and what collaborative casework is actually all about. We talk about how do we together build a safe future that's going to last, that's going to be effective, that's going to have an impact, and what does it mean to have a responsibility towards others, and how can this affect what it means ultimately for us as humans. Let me read you a quote from a book that we also talk about called The Locust Effect. Quote, "We have come to see with some urgency that criminal justice systems are indispensable for the poor, and we know from history that it's possible to build them. But we also know that building them is difficult, costly, dangerous, and unlikely. What we need, therefore, are bold projects of hope." I'll end it there, close quote, bold projects of hope. That's from a book called The Locust Effect. We talk about that as well, and then the subtitle of the book is Why the End of Poverty Requires the End of Violence. I think you're going to really enjoy this interview. We cover a lot of ground, and we talk, too, about what's the downside to sharing this world with others. DavidPeckLive.com for more interviews there. We're well over 200 now. I've got a bunch of interviews I've just recently done with filmmakers from the Toronto International Film Festival. If you'd like a copy of my book, Real Change is Incremental, you can get it there online. And if you'd like to book me for your next event, please connect with me through my website at DavidPeckLive.com. Coming up, Ed Wilson. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest again here today, Ed Wilson, who is IJM's Executive Director. That's the International Justice Mission here in Canada. Ed Wilson is here with us today. Thanks for your time today, Ed, and for joining
us. You're welcome,
David. Yeah, good to chat. We've been trying to set this up for quite some time.
Glad we're finally able to talk.
We are finally able to talk. Your first day back from holidays, I understand. So I'll go easy on
that.
I'm gonna go easy on you. How's that?
Okay.
So I've got a whole long list of things to talk about, but I think a great place to start, Ed, is why don't you just give us kind of the overview of what IJM actually is and what they do. And I mean, you know, I could certainly read, you know, your vision and your mission statement off your website. And for those of you who are listening and taking notes, it's IJM.ca, and we'll have that up online as well. But tell us a little bit about the organization and what you're all about.
Well, as you mentioned, David, I'm the Executive Director of International Justice Mission Canada, and we are part of a global organization that comprises six independent organizations based in the U.S., Canada, U.K., Germany, Netherlands, and Australia, who partner together to protect the poor from violence throughout the developing world. And in those locations, 17 different communities throughout Africa, Latin America, South and Southeast Asia, we partner with local authorities to rescue victims of violence. We also bring criminals to justice, we restore survivors, and strengthen justice systems. And our vision is that through our partnership with local law enforcement, we will, for the sake of the poor who are typically defenseless, we will build a safe future that lasts. And so we are really looking at long-term transformation of justice systems within the developing world context. So that's what we do. Canada, as I mentioned, is a member of this partnership of organizations that functions under the mission and vision of International Justice Mission, with a shared vision, shared mission. And it's very exciting to have this opportunity that I do to be a part of this great movement that's growing throughout the world. I think what I've seen in the last 10, 15 years is a growing awareness on the part of those of us who live in the global north, if I can use that expression, of our responsibility to leverage the privileges and responsibilities that we have for the sake of the protection of the poor in the developing world.
I want to talk about that responsibility in a second, Ed, and why, not only why you feel it, but why you feel that we here in the global north have this, almost this moral obligation to look beyond ourselves, I guess is maybe a good way to put it. Would you call IJM a development organization?
I think you could use that expression. We typically would refer to ourselves as a development organization. We try to avoid being categorized as a human rights organization.
Oh, okay.
Because our focus is not so much on human rights, but although that is a knock-on effect of the work that we do, that the rights of individuals are respected and protected, but we do work in the development sector. That's correct.
So that's sort of how you differentiate yourself, would you say, from, say, an Amnesty International? They're primarily active with respect to human rights and so on, and on behalf of individuals. You guys are more, would you almost say, more from a legal perspective, you know, going after slavery and sex trafficking and so on. Is that kind of the distinction?
We do our work from a law enforcement model. That is certainly correct. And we, if I can just talk for a minute about our methodology.
Mm-hmm.
We begin in a location by doing collaborative casework. And by collaborative, I mean we work in partnership with local authorities as individual cases of violent oppression of the poor are brought to our attention. We work to bring the local law enforcement systems on side with us to advocate for proper respectful treatment of the individuals who have been abused and suffered violence. We work through the courts in the country. But in that process of doing collaborative casework, we're able to develop a diagnosis of where the local justice system is lacking in its effectiveness, and then propose certain improvements to the justice system, which are typically not improvements to the law, because in most cases the laws are quite good and sound in and of themselves, but they are not being enforced, or if they're being enforced at all within the country context, they're not being enforced for the poor. I mean, one of the things that we find is in the developing world context, quite often, most often, the rich are able to secure protection for themselves because they have the financial resources to pay for it.
Right.
They can pay for private security. But in a country where law enforcement is under-resourced, not a priority within a system that is struggling in so many other ways, the poor lack protection.
Right.
So we are then able, through the collaborative casework that we do, to develop a diagnosis of where the justice system needs to be strengthened. And it may be something as basic as the as children in the court system being given special treatment out of regard for the sensitivity of the issues that they have that are being processed in the court, so that children are not being re-traumatized by having to go through a trial process where they're required again to recite the details of the abuse that they suffered. So something like developing child-sensitive procedures in courts. That, you know, when I'm talking about developing a diagnosis, it may be something as simple as that. Or in a case like India, where bonded labor has been illegal since 1976, since the passage of the Bonded Labor Slavery Act in India, no processes were developed for recognizing that individuals were actually being treated as slaves and needed to be their mistreatment needed to be acknowledged in a legal sense, and some process needed to be developed to acknowledge their mistreatment and grant those individuals freedom from the abuse that they were suffering. And so we have collaborated with the government of India to develop a process which involves the provision of these former bonded laborers with a release certificate to identify the fact that they are now free from the obligation under which they labored and suffered for so long. So we develop this diagnosis. We implement new procedures that will result in a strengthening of the justice system and perhaps even a quite radical transformation of the justice system. And then, given the passage of some time, we are able to step back from the work that we've done in partnership with local authorities and move into a position of monitoring the gains that have been achieved over a period of time.
So why do you personally feel this responsibility? Why does IJM feel a responsibility, or any development worker for that matter, to the Global South, to the majority world, or the two-thirds world? I mean, as I sometimes will say, and others do too, I don't know about you, Ed, but from time to time, because of the work I do, people will say, well, how come you're not concerned about the problems here in Canada? I mean, don't we have these issues here too? And, why there and not here, And that's, in my mind, a very cynical sort of approach. But I'm always not only surprised by that, but my initial reaction is usually one of kind of anger. But I'm learning to sort of, footnote that more and more every day, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly to respond to the question you raise, which is often posed to us as well. Why are you focused on problems in the developing world? What about those who suffer injustice in our own country?
Mm-hmm.
It's true. There are needs in our own environment as well. But relatively speaking, I don't think anyone can argue with this statement I'm about to make, is that relatively speaking, more resources are available to those who are in need in our country and in the United States and Europe than would be the case in the Global South. But I think we also need to remember that it is not so long ago. If you look back into the 19th century, you would be able to find situations, even in North America, in some of our large cities, where violence was rampant, and the poor were subject to oppression and with very few resources dedicated to their support. So I think we should, while we do say that the needs are greater in the developing world, we shouldn't take that posture out of some sense of smugness that we are beyond the kinds of violence and deprivation that the poor suffer from in the developing world. You also asked what motivates me.
Well, yeah, what motivates and why I love the word responsibility. I mean, I truly believe that, but I don't know that everyone does. And I having just returned from Southeast Asia and Cambodia, I'm not sure people globally have that deep of a concern for others, and yet maybe I'm wrong about that, but it doesn't seem to be playing out it seems to me, in that way in the West. But, you know, I interviewed somebody about volunteerism a couple of days ago, and they had nothing but good things to say about people in the U.S. and the West and how wonderful they are and how much time they give and so on. So, yeah, I'm interested to know what your thoughts are on that whole capital R responsibility notion.
Well, for me, I think part of my personal story is that I grew up in an isolated community in northern Ontario where even, 30, 40 years ago, it was quite rare for someone to leave that community and venture out into the bigger world. I did, and I benefited from having teachers and mentors throughout my adolescent years who encouraged me to dream big.
Right.
And I think coming out of that, that childhood and adolescent experience, I've gained a sense of responsibility to use the privilege that I've enjoyed for the benefit of others. And to be frank with you, my worldview has been shaped by my faith in the Judeo-Christian God, who I understand to be the God of justice and the God of poor, the God of the universe, a God who is active in all places and in all situations, even the most, the darkest and most discouraging situations. And I think that, that sense of being privileged myself, coupled with the worldview that I've adopted, it imparts to me a sense of responsibility to use the gifts and abilities and capacities that I have for the benefit of others.
Ed, can I ask you this blend of a question? Do you think that, do you think so? Privilege, great, love it. Do you leads towards responsibility? Do you think faith primarily leads towards a responsibility to others? And I guess my question sort of is that a requirement? Is that a necessity?
I don't think it's a requirement. I think it's part of our humanness, and of course, my perspective on what it means to be human is shaped by my worldview.
Right.
But I think anyone who's in touch with our humanness, with what it means to be a human being, with what it means to be a member of the human race, mm-hmm. with an understanding of who we share the world with, how much. Chance, or use whatever another word if you wish, destiny or providence, right, plays into that. The decision of why I was born in Canada of
right.
all places in the
right.
world.
Right.
Why I was privileged to have people around me who encouraged me to share my life with others, to share my gifts with others. I mean, these are things that, irrespective of your worldview, I think anyone who is in touch with their humanness should be motivated to benefit others. Certainly my worldview, my faith, has been an important part of my journey, but I don't think that's something that is intrinsic or exclusive to people of faith. I think it has more to do with as much to do with just being aware of responsibility that comes from sharing the planet with billions of other people.
Well, I kind of often say, like, what is the downside to sharing the planet? What is the downside to bending towards grace and to generosity? But I think a lot of people, I'm just busy trying to make my own ends meet here, folks. I've got my own. It's kind of like, if it's not in my backyard, I'm not really that interested, right? That's sometimes the sense that I get, and I'm always trying to fight against that.
That way of living is foreign to me. I don't understand it. And I think one of the things that I have the opportunity to do is to encourage people to pay attention to their neighbors.
It's good. It's good.
And certainly that's part of the Christian way of life, the body of teaching that comes with Christianity, Jesus' teaching on loving your neighbor as yourself, but Again, I think it's part of the awareness of what it means to be human.
What it means
to share this space, this world, for the time that we do with others. And my life and the lives of people that I spend time with have been enriched by paying attention to the needs of those around them and not being afraid to intervene. Today, my wife came home from a run. I made it home a little bit before she did, and she came in the house and said, "You won't believe what just happened." And on the street just behind where our house is, on her way home, she had noticed there were a couple people on bicycles who were weaving their way down the street and interfering with traffic. And a driver took offense at these bicyclists' behavior and stepped out of his car and began verbally and then physically threatening them.
Oh boy. Okay.
And the bicyclist responded to the threat, and it looked really as if there was going to be a physical altercation
right.
in the middle of the street. And my wife intervened, and she said, "You guys, stop it. Stop what you're doing. You're all acting like idiots. Now get out of here." And she could just have easily said, "That's none of my business.
Right.
Why should I put myself at risk for the sake of others?" But I think that's the kind of behavior that results from paying attention to where we live and accepting some responsibility for the general well-being of the communities that we are a part of.
Well, I think in some ways, where I'm starting to land is, faith or no faith, is that I think a starting point has to be that we don't exist without others, in a sense.
Yeah.
And so we don't know who we are without our wives and our husbands and our kids and our partners and our families and our friends. And I think we can easily extend that to those in our neighborhoods and beyond. So why wouldn't we is the better question,
yeah.
I think, in some respects, or at least that's where I'm landing. Tell me a little bit about Gary Hagen and how he maybe has inspired you and how he's built this organization. But I think more importantly, I want to talk about his book, The Locust Effect, which has recently been published and getting quite a bit of attention, subtitled Why the End of Poverty Requires the End of Violence. Bill Clinton says, quote, "A compelling reminder that if we are to create a 21st century of shared prosperity," there you go, shared prosperity, "we cannot turn a blind eye to the violence that threatens our common humanity," close quote. It's a wonderful quote. No matter what side of the fence you sit on, I think you would have to agree with that. So yeah, a couple questions there, Ed, but tossing out the locust, and then maybe tell us what the heck the locust effect actually is.
Yeah, well, about Gary first. Gary is the CEO and founder of International Justice Mission, this global partnership that I talked about earlier, and he's a Harvard and University of Chicago trained lawyer, extremely brilliant man. I highly respect Gary for his intellect and his vision and his leadership skills. I think the most formative experience of Gary's that really compelled him to do the work that he's done to build the organization that IJM is today was an experience that he had in Rwanda in 1994. When he was seconded by the U.S. Department of Justice to lead a forensic investigation on behalf of the U.N. into the genocide in Rwanda.
And right.
There he was in a little church in Rwanda that I also have visited, sifting through the human remains and had what I call a crisis of faith, calling out to God, asking God, "Where were you when all of this took place?"
I've done some work on in Rwanda and actually visited the same church, so I know whereof you speak, that whole
church in Nadarama.
Yes,
and I mean, you cannot visit that church without your emotions being torn apart. It's such a gripping, and even today, so many years later, it's such a graphic memorial to the devastation that took place at that point in Rwanda's history. But the answer that Gary heard back was more or less these words: "And where was my church?" And that's not about what did the Roman Catholic Church do, where was the church and other churches, evangelical churches, where were they when all of that took place? But in the face of ongoing violence and injustice, Gary's sense was that that Christians, followers of God, and people of goodwill had a responsibility to intervene in situations like that to the extent of their ability. And it goes back again to this matter of personal responsibility, answering the question that that Jesus answered with the parable of the Good Samaritan, who is my neighbor? And so that led to the creation of the organization International Justice Mission. And over time, the focus of the International Justice Mission has coalesced around this central theme of strengthening law enforcement systems for the sake of the protection of the poor, so and a realization that the end of poverty requires the end of violence against the poor. And we're aware of ongoing situations of mass conflict, like the horrendous situation in Syria today and in other places in the world. But even beyond that, there is the locust effect. The book The Locust Effect sets forth the argument that there is a massive hidden plague of everyday violence that is destroying the lives of poor people throughout the developing world. And it's hidden because it is as much a part of poverty as hunger, illness, or lack of access to education. But it's much harder to see, and it's everyday violence. It's expressed in criminal acts like rape and sex trafficking, forced labor, slavery, police brutality. So much so that many of the much needed expressions of development assistance that are provided to the poor in the world lack in effectiveness because violence, this plague of everyday violence, prevents the poor from taking full advantage of those other forms of assistance. So to use an example that's far too real, a school can be, and schools are being built, and schools need to be built in countries like Afghanistan. But if young girls fear that they will be raped en route to school in the morning, they won't leave home.
Right.
And so this very real threat of everyday violence prevents children and adults from taking advantage of other forms of assistance that are provided to them. So this everyday violence blocks the road out of poverty. It undermines the help the world is trying to give.
So would Gary... How would Gary define violence? How would you define violence? I mean, I think I and my listeners probably know what have been, and many of us have probably, have succumbed to some of that along the way. Are we talking about emotional? Is it spiritual? I mean, are we talking about abuse? Or is it just the threat of it is violent? Is a violent act in and of itself? Because he talks about what he calls de facto lawlessness in the book. And I just wonder, is that almost, living in an ethos of just wondering when,
But I think that's certainly part of the reality. But that ethos of wondering when is created by the very real factual presence of criminal violence. And so for the sake of our discussion, I would define violence as criminal acts of violence focused primarily on the poor of this world. And so I've named off some criminal acts of violence already: rape, sex trafficking, forced labor, slavery, police abuse of power, theft of land and property from the poor. And all of these are expressions of criminal violence that IJM is engaged in addressing in partnership with local authorities.
When you read the book, I mean, it's not until near the end of the book that you start to see. In fact, I think he has a chapter at the end of the book, Demonstration Projects of Hope. He actually talks about specific examples of things that are happening, that are showing good signs. I mean, one of the other things I really love, and I'll see if I can find the quote somewhere, but he basically says pretty much every society
has suffered from this at one time or another. And so that in itself is a reason to hope. And even to your point earlier, the laws are good. It's just they're not being enforced. So it seems when you read the book, when you start to reflect on this, this is just such a massive, overwhelming problem. How can we even deal with hunger if this isn't being attended to? Or should we even bother with that while this remains unattended?
You were breaking up a little bit, David.
Oh.
You might want to...
Yeah, so I guess what the question really is it seems like a massive, overwhelming problem. Gary ends the book with a chapter about, actual projects of hope around the world, specific examples where things are getting better, where there are good reasons to believe that change is coming. It seems like it's almost too big of an issue to take on for the individual, other than, I guess, say, writing a check.
I think in terms of addressing these countrywide systemic problems of injustice, I don't think it is an individual venture, but it certainly is not insurmountable. I don't think we've really given it our best efforts yet to address the problem of everyday violence. Gary talks about the analysis that he's done in the book, The Locus Effect. He talks about it, and it appears that less than 1% of international development aid coming from major global aid institutions like USAID and the World Bank is targeted to help improve justice systems, protect the poor from everyday violence. And much of the aid that is labeled as aid for the strengthening of justice systems is actually focused on preventing terrorism and countering drug trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't believe that the world has seen yet the potential effects and effectiveness of investing in strengthening law enforcement systems. But we do have some great early success stories that we can report. One comes from Cambodia, and I know you care very deeply about the country of Cambodia.
We do indeed.
But in the early 2000s, research reported by the Cambodian government estimated the prevalence of minors being exploited in the commercial sex industry was as high as 30% in the city of Phnom Penh. Our IJM's 2015 prevalence study found that the prevalence of minors in the commercial sex trade in the three largest commercial sex markets in the country, Phnom Penh, Siem Reap, and Sihanoukville, had dropped to 2.2% from perhaps as high as 30%
wow.
in the early 2000s, with minors 15 years and younger making up less than 0.1% of the sex industry. So this represents a 73% reduction in the presence of minors in just 3 years since we conducted a previous prevalence study in 2012. And we're very encouraged by what we've seen in Cambodia. It's certainly not anything that IJM can take sole credit for. We've worked as a member of a partnership of organizations focusing on the issue of sex trafficking of minors. And someone like Helen Sworn, who's founder and international director of the Chab Dai Coalition in Cambodia, says that for many years this felt like a long, dark tunnel.
Right.
But now she sees police and the government standing up and saying that sex trafficking is not acceptable. And she goes on to say that this brings her hope that not just on this particular issue, but on other issues as well, there's hope for Cambodia.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that Cambodia and other countries who have battled similar issues don't still have a long way to go. But the transformation that we've seen in Cambodia in the last 15 years, I think, is a demonstration to those observing IJM's work that justice for the poor is possible.
Remarkable statistics. So, sadly, we're going to have to wrap up the conversation here shortly, Ed, but I want to ask a question about corruption. So, so to me, corruption is sort of an act of violence in a sense, because if you're constantly feeling as if, what's the point? In fact, I think Gary quotes a poverty expert that basically said it's become the expected norm, right, in some countries around the world. We have corruption here. I mean, we do. You can't get away from it. You see it almost every day in one way, shape, or form. But it doesn't seem to have the same life and death sort of implications. So I guess my question is, if personal security, as Gary says, is sort of the, this is what we need in the Global South in order to move forward, in order to attend to things like poverty and extreme poverty and hunger and malnutrition and so on, how do you do that when you're not, governments around the world aren't even paying their police force enough to live? And so it almost seems to me like corruption is just the only way, in a sense. So if I can make a little bit of extra money, well, I'm going to charge you to do that because I got to feed my family. Does that make sense?
It certainly does, and corruption is endemic, but it's not inevitable, and it's almost an act of statement of faith on the part of IJM to believe that in every context, no matter how desperate it seems, we will find, eventually, we will find men and women of goodwill who are prepared to do the right thing in spite of the opportunity to gain personally through participating in bribery and graft and corruption. And it's taken years in some cases, but we've seen entire police departments in certain communities turned around based on our commitment to be persistent and relentless and fearless in our pursuit of those individuals in positions of influence and power who are prepared to do the right thing when they are presented with the challenge. And so we, and Gary mentions this in the book as well, that there is something that's like a rule of thumb for us. It's a 15-70-15 rule, which says that in any given context, there are 15% of the people who get out of the bed in the morning, and they are inclined to do the wrong thing. There's another 15% who are by nature inclined to do the right thing, and the other 70% are waiting to see which way the wind is blowing.
Right.
And we have been, through our relentless pursuit of those 15% who are inclined to do the right thing, we've been able to turn police departments around so that previously they blocked every effort that we made to pursue justice on behalf of the poor, and now they have become our champions. And they are leading the charge. They are initiating investigations themselves. And in the course of 5-6 years, we've seen a total transformation in the attitude of a police department. But it began with this our relentlessness, and it began with a dogged pursuit at various levels of individuals who are prepared to do the right thing on behalf of the poor. And so it takes me back to IJM's vision statement, which states that we are committed to rescue thousands, protect millions, and prove that justice for the poor is possible. And I'm particularly inspired by the last aspect of that statement, because I think it speaks to the despair that Christians and others often feel in the face of situations in the world. We think, how can we possibly turn around?
Yes.
The situation in South Sudan, or how can Afghanistan ever be rehabilitated? And what is there any hope for Syria? And I don't have the specific answer for any of those situations, but I think we do need to approach those situations and others like them with that attitude of believing that justice for the poor is possible.
Well, I think
that
the simple, this, I mean, I
possible.
Think, yeah, absolutely.
For our world is possible.
Absolutely. No, I totally appreciate your sense of not only responsibility and passion and commitment to the other and to the neighbor and so on, but this idea that the splash and ripple effect is possible, that it's happening either way, and the question is which way are you going to, which 15% are you, almost in a sense. Can I just, we're going to have to wrap it up here, but I want to read a quote near the end of the book. Quote, Gary says, "We have also stumbled upon a surprising hope. First, from history, we have encountered the unexpected story that just about every criminal justice system that can now be relied upon to work reasonably well was once utterly corrupt, abusive, and dysfunctional." Close quote.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think, how can you not be hopeful? You know, in some respects, when you know that, when you say, well, yes, it's a bit of a mess, folks, that doesn't mean you just roll over and go back to sleep.
That's right. And you know, my understanding of biblical justice, and as we've mentioned already, I'm a person of faith. I you know, follow the teachings of Jesus Christ to the best of my ability. I take guidance from the Judeo-Christian scriptures. My understanding of justice is that I can simplify it with these words. It's about doing the right thing in public. Mm. And too often, I think, faith and religion and ethics have been turned into matters of private morality.
Mm.
And private morality is important. I think we ought to care about what, you know, what I do in secret as well. But our world it will be changed as more and more of us determine to do the right thing in public. And it's accepting the responsibility that we've spoken about earlier to my neighbors, the people that I share this world with. And I think it's that, you know, that it's that attitude that will, you know, will result in the transformation of our communities, that result in the transformation of our justice systems, and will make it impossible for me to be silent when I see corruption and injustice in my local community as well as in the global world that I am a part of as well.
Ed Wilson is the executive director of the International Justice Mission here in Canada. Their website is ijm.ca. Check them out online. Ed, thanks a lot for your time. I mean, talk about scratching the surface. I've thoroughly enjoyed our chat today. I hope we can do a part two down the road. And again, I really appreciate your time and your insights and your passion.
Well, thanks so much for setting up this conversation today. Appreciate it a lot.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.